Welcome to the Truth Expedition. I'm your host, Mark Bischofsky. On this show, we scratch, we claw, we dig, we pry, we grind. We try to uncover some truth in this crazy world where fact checkers lie and our government and the media propagandizes us. We try to uncover some truth, which is difficult to do in this world. On today's episode, I will introduce you to Brooke Jackson. Brooke was a contractor. Her company was contracted through Pfizer to oversee clinical trials for the COVID vaccine. And what she witnessed, the things that she saw were very alarming, and she ended up blowing the whistle. The details are for you to see in the interview, going to court, getting thrown out. Her battle is not over. She is a warrior. Her courage is inspirational, and it ought to inspire everyone to step up and do more. You can find out more about Brooke at IamBrookeJackson.com. Follow her on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is IamBrookeJackson. I hope you enjoy this interview. I enjoyed talking to Brooke. Like I said, she is a hero in this movement, in this medical freedom movement, this movement that got me into activism, that got me into politics. So I admire her so much. So please enjoy that interview. On next week's show, I'm going to interview Liz Collins. So Liz is the author of the book They're Lying, and that book talks about the George Floyd incident, which happened here in Minneapolis, and how the media was lying and withholding truth about that incident. So I can't wait to talk to Liz. That'll be on next week's show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy this interview with Brooke Jackson. Stay free, don't tread on me, and don't shed on me. All right, audience, for the Truth Expedition, it is what an honor today to be with a fellow freedom fighter who has been fighting this craziness that we're seeing in this world for a couple of years now. I had the honor of meeting her a few months ago, and I was a whistleblower, but the whistle that was blown by my guest today was louder, it was more piercing, and invaluable to our movement. And what a pleasure, and to be able to spend some time here today with Brooke Jackson, the infamous, famous whistleblower. So thanks for being here, Brooke.
Kind, Mark, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it, and it was great to meet you. And when I was down in were we in Minnesota that time?
Yes, we were. Yeah,
we were. Yeah. So thank you again for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And my audience, I'm sure, is I know there was a lot of excitement when I let them know that Brooke Jackson was going to be on. So let's start with who is Brooke Jackson? I mean, before the commencing of the dispersal of this chemical injection, who was Brooke Jackson before this all happened?
God, that's a good question. When I think back to the last 3 years of my life, I described myself as a soccer mom, because I really was just that. I was a soccer mom. I have two beautiful children that love to play soccer and volleyball. I play volleyball, and we love to go camping. I'm married. We have a camper, an RV. We do that on the weekends, but I had a job and I had a career. And that career was in clinical research. And for 20 years, I worked for not many companies. I tend to keep the jobs that I had, but important roles in hospital systems in the Dallas. We were just talking about the veterans and the Dallas VA Medical Centers, where I started my career. I was there for almost 10 years. I moved into another hospital system and worked in liver and kidney transplant research for almost 5 years. And then I started to move into, upper management and director level type positions in clinical research and all types of research. I've done, you name the therapeutic area, I'm sure I've done it. Devices, again, transplant, therapeutics, biologics, vaccines. So this was my area of expertise. And running a clinical trial is not an easy job. I depended on my trial staff and other members of leadership to make sure that when we are working on any clinical trial, that the data is backed by integrity, that it's accurate, that it's true, that, you know, it actually happened. This is, you know, clinical research and medicines, these devices, this is the future of medicine. I have had the honor and privilege of watching a medicine in the very first clinical trial phases go on to be what is used as a standard of care today. I've seen that over and over again. And clinical research mattered to me, and it matters to me still. I still believe that we are going to overcome what's gone on in the last 3 years, even rather before then, right? Because it's just now that I've come to the realization of what's actually, how drugs actually come to market. And it blows my mind. But I still have faith that we're going to correct the system and make it better for our future children.
Yeah, people will need to go to jail or worse for that to happen, I think. I mean, because, you know, I have never really ever trusted the system. I was raised in a family where my dad always said, the world is a scam, question everything, be careful who you trust. So for many years, I've been digging in like natural health. So I've never trusted many of these medications. I don't know if you've looked at like how statins, for instance, were, you know, the lies behind so many of these drugs. Not that there's not a place for them, but using relative risk versus absolute risk and the manipulation and throwing out studies that don't, you know, don't have the narrative they want them to have. So, you know, I've always been questioning it.
So you think that's because of your upbringing?
Well, I mean, I'm just naturally one to question everything. Okay. And so,
I'm just curious about that because, you know, I work in that environment, and my growing up, I'm from a military family, and we didn't question much. I have this built-in, I guess, system of trust. I use my gut sense a lot when I'm meeting people or when I'm making a decision. How does it make me feel? I pray about things. So I don't know. It's just interesting to me how some people just automatically knew that this, you know, vaccine, and that's always in quotes, right? This vaccine
right away.
was the, you know, evil. And here I am, somebody who's been, you know, working in this field for 20 years, I didn't question anything except how this company I worked for was going to submit the data to Pfizer and be able to sleep at night. I couldn't. I worked for this company, Ventavia Research Group, in September of 2020 on Pfizer's phase 3 clinical trial for 18 days. And I didn't sleep much during those 18 days because of everything that I was seeing. It was, and I've said this before, I've never seen a clinical trial run in a way that actually made me fearful for the patient's safety. And this one did.
Well, that's good to know that, you know, a lot of the trials, from what you're saying, are legitimate. But, you know, like if you just kind of staying on that topic of trust, you know, I feel like, and there'll be a question following this, but I just came across this concept, pathocracy, where we are, you know, this is a country of psychopaths, by psychopaths, for psychopaths. I mean, really, it's coming, you know, to be almost true. But like, take 9/11. 9/11, when you know, in the years, the months following that, did you question that at all? And does this not, because that to me is like the mainstream narrative of that is absolutely not true. Same with JFK, Oklahoma City bombing. The more I learn, the more I dig into all these other things. But like this whole 9/11 thing, there's a lot of information missing, and what the heck happened there? And I don't know if you like the PREP Act was introduced, which allowed a lot of this, was introduced shortly after. You know, how long is, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in the know, you know, since this has happened, and I'm not going to say who, but people really deeply embedded are telling me this was all planned, you know.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, you,
Mark, that takes a lot of, I'm with you. I hear you on the 9/11, you know, for Mr. Kennedy. Yeah. I'm with you. But how long did it take you to figure that out? It's taken me from, you know, it's taken me a good year and a half to 2 years to do my own study, to do my own research in the background, you know, to question everything. Took and takes time for my thought process and how I come to a decision. And I wonder, like, if that's how other people's minds work, and that's why some people just don't get it at this point, because they haven't had, you know, something that's opened their eyes to what it is. Is it just ingrained in your being, or is questioning and knowing things that we know now just a journey? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. You know, yeah. People are busy. People are busy, and it's hard. I know a lot of people, like, I've presented a lot of data, information to some people, and they agree, but they literally, like, they put a wall up, and they're like, I don't want to know. It's too much. You know, yeah. It's a step too far for me to not trust my government. Well, there's a lot of that. And, you know, I don't like to, you know, I want to love everyone, and it's hard. And I think people need to discover on their own. It's hard. Nobody's going to listen to me. You could give them the truth on a silver platter, and it has to be self-discovery for most people. You can't jam this down their throat. And, you know, it might take something like what you witnessed to start. Cause you know, we just all want to live our lives. We just want to be with our families and enjoy life. So
I think you're right. And the psychology of it all, I think, is a huge factor. And when you realize that the people within our, some people within our, I think there are good people in every company, every branch of government, every FDA, CDC, I believe that there are good people there still. I'm not going to let my mind go to the place that everybody that works there is evil, but I know that there are some psychopaths and that are running this country, that are running these companies. And the first person that I ever heard describe them that way was Dr. Asim Malhotra, when I asked him how are these people doing this, and he said they're freaking psychopaths.
They are. That's how. You know, so,
and I was like, okay, that's a very, very easy way to just absorb that. They're crazy.
It's hard to relate because we're not that way. We have empathy. Right. We have empathy. So it's really hard to figure how can somebody just not care. But for the viewers out there, and for you too, Brooke, so there's James Corbett is an investigative journalist, alternative news source, CorbettReport.com. He had just put out an expose on psychopathy and how it's been going on forever. And as many as 4% of the population are borderline. And people have done research, and many of our presidents really fit that, you know, category, and many of our corporate leaders. So, you know, they're out there, and they would like you to believe that it's the Hollywood version of a psychopath that we need to fear, the axe murderer, or Silence of the Lambs. But, you know, they're scary. But the cunning psychopath who's strategic, and they're the more dangerous ones that have, as we've witnessed, can do much more harm. All the people that are dying and suffering from this bioweapon, that's psychopathy at its worst. And so you were working.
I have chills.
Yeah, isn't it? It's, and we have kids, and it's for them. You know, I can fend for myself, but I'll be damned if I'm not going to fight tooth and nail until I have no breath left. This is the hill I die on, to make sure that your kids and my kids live in a decent world. And so that's what we're fighting for. But so you were working for Ventavia, which is I don't know how to describe, third party. You weren't working for Pfizer, but you were overseeing some of their trials, right? And
that's right. That's
so was it BioNTech, or was it Folsom Pharmaceuticals? Are you familiar? So, like, I'm really getting deep into this. So who the hell is even making these things? Who's actually making these vaccines?
That's a good question. You know, I know that when I was working in the clinical trials, the sponsor of the study, the pharmaceutical company, was Pfizer. They are the ones that submitted all the data to the FDA in support of the emergency use authorization, in support of, you know, their full licensure. So those are great questions. And as you dig in, it's crazy.
Yeah, because Fosun is a Chinese Communist Party company, wholly owned. So yes. When you go down that rabbit
these
hole,
these governments and private partnerships that have been there, and especially, you know, since 2019, really 2020, that have been formed, you know, it's so obvious and so clear to me what's going on, and it's just being allowed. And until we have, you know, some reform in our judiciary and our legislatures coming to our rescue, we're just going to have to keep talking about it, Mark. There's, you know, showing up and these school board meetings for me was eye-opening too. You know, so I've become active there, talking to my state reps, my, you know, even my county reps. I was invited to speak to our, you know, county judge here, and he heard about the story and invited me down. So just using my voice to tell people what I experienced and how they violated every standard of making sure that this vaccine was safe and effective. It wasn't in 2020, and it's certainly not today, and how these psychopaths are able to just ignore the VAERS data. You know, the number of harms is just outrageous, and we have to keep speaking up. We have to keep it current in their face, and everybody plays a part in that by reaching out to their state, their local, our federal my phone went off and I'm totally distracted.
No worries. We're casual here. We're just having a conversation. So there's no worries.
We have to get involved and hopefully can make some change. What's super disappointing in my case, my lawsuit that I filed in January of 2021, is that we had and have a Democratic DOJ in office right now. And to know that if that was different, if there was a Republican in office, that the case would likely have been intervened by the government and maybe would have held Pfizer responsible. But it's a political issue, which is infuriating to me because I've never been into politics. You know, certainly I voted and paid attention, but I didn't, not like today, really. I mean, it's like, it's wild. It's wild to me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we do have to keep fighting. And what's most infuriating to me is, you know, I founded Stop the Mandate. I was having big rallies. And at first, when a lot of these healthcare workers were at risk of losing their job, if, you know, and, but once they got their exemption, they left the scene. And I'm like, this isn't over. You may have, you know, it's a little bit of selfishness, and maybe some of those will be viewing this. And I'm sorry, but this is not over. This fight continues, and it is important. It's the most important fight you've ever had in your entire life. What's happening in this world right now, just because you got your job back? No, you need to stay in the fold. And you need to keep fighting for your kids, because this is going to happen again and again and again and again. So I thank you, Brooke, for continuing, for everything you've done. So what was like, if you can name a couple things, like when you were overseeing these trials, what were a couple of the issues you were seeing that you hadn't seen before? Like, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah. So the company I worked for, Ventavia Research Group, like you mentioned, it was a subcontractor of Pfizer's. And think about, you know, when you're enrolling into a clinical trial and you need 30,000 patients to test your product to make sure that it's safe and effective and that it works, Pfizer doesn't have access to 30,000 patients and just a database. So they contract out with different companies, different physicians' offices, different organizations to recruit patients from different, different areas. So you don't want a clinical trial with just a localized group of patients. You want it to be diverse in, age and race and, potentially comorbidities. And, you want a diverse clinical trial. So this company that I was working for was out of Fort Worth. We were enrolling patients into this clinical trial in three different locations, two in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and one in Houston, Texas. And I was overseeing two of those trials. And I will tell you, from the day that I walked in, the first thing that I saw was a lack of informed consent. And we can talk about that, 3 years later today. There is a true lack of informed consent when any patient, any adolescent, any baby is given this injection, because people are not fully informed of what they're putting into their bodies. They weren't then, and they're certainly not now, but a lack of informed consent. And in clinical research, when you're having a surgery, when you're getting a tooth extracted, it doesn't matter. Informed consent is the most important thing. And it's not just a moment where you sign something and date something. It is an understanding of what is about to happen to you. Yeah. And especially in research, I love to share my knowledge, and I've done that in clinical research and taught clinical research to new graduates of, certain programs and who are interested in getting involved. And that is the number one most important thing. And it never stops. When you're participating in a clinical trial, it's a continuous process, informed consent is. So every time you have contact with that patient, if there's any new information that's been made available, you keep that conversation, that open with the patient. Do you want to continue into this clinical trial? Here's a new informed consent. But that was the number one thing. I would say the second, I always think of five. Could I give you five right off the top of my head? Safety of patients was right after that informed consent. We were not following patients per Pfizer's own protocol. That per Pfizer's own protocol should have immediately stopped us from seeing any more patients until we were able to speak with Pfizer. Mixing up of specimens from one patient to the next, not storing the product at the appropriate temperature. What did that do to the product? Did it make it less potent? I hope so.
Yeah, that's what people are saying. Yeah.
Did it cause more damage? Not collecting these adverse events and these serious adverse events, not making sure that patients were completing their diaries appropriately, these devices that we've sent home with them after they were injected to monitor their symptoms, not seeing patients. Everybody was, and myself included, I'm myself included, afraid, right? Because that's all you heard on television, COVID, it's going to kill you. We have to find new therapies. This vaccine's going to be it. I was concerned about it. I didn't want to get it. I didn't want to give it, but I was excited. I was eager to work on this vaccine because this was what was going to, be another tool in our toolbox to help end this pandemic worldwide. But my point was, these patients were not being seen appropriately. And I think that a lot of that had to do with the fear, because if they were sick, the staff didn't want them to come to the office necessarily and be swabbed. And, so that was a concern. I literally could go on and on and on about the problems. The point is in 20 years, I've never seen a clinical trial run this quickly, this sloppily, and a lot of it, is that a word?
Sloppily. I think so. I like it.
Cool. and a lot of it was just sloppy research. And I talk about those sloppy little things like, needles in a trash can, although that's a safety hazard. And I did have to report that to OSHA. That was really to set the scene. If you don't know as a clinical researcher that a used sharp goes in a sharp container, not a plastic bag, there's a problem. So imagine what the data collection looks like, or, how they're processing lab samples when you can't even throw a used needle away correctly. So that was really to lay out the scene of what this looked like. But the majority of what I reported was material to this product's approval, the safety of the product. Does it work? Is it effective? The things that I was reporting could have changed that.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate. Did you see any, got lots of questions, but like, did you see them hiding data?
Oh yeah, certainly.
And yes. So what about other people that, so you're the director overseeing this, but obviously there's other people working beneath you. Mm-hmm. And were these people just going to work, doing their job and not willing to see it, not seeing it, not caring? I mean, how do you, that's a big thing for me. Like, how are these doctors? And I'm sure the same thing for you. Like, how are you not seeing this?
That's a great question. Like, where are my colleagues? Where are my colleagues? I've had a handful. Where are these doctors? I've had a couple, one or two, that works on this clinical trial from other locations that have contacted me. And we can talk about that a little bit when we maybe talk about where we are with the case. But they saw it. I saw it with my own eyes. Workers, researchers that were fabricating and falsifying data. I watched it, you know, like with a side eye. I'm like, that's happening right now. And every morning at 8 o'clock, and again, I was only there for 18 days. It took me 18 days to do an evaluation. I'm a certified clinical trial auditor. So some of these things that in the data, like my eye goes straight to, like signatures not matching. And that's, you know, that's a simple hold up two pieces of paper that have a signature on it. Do they match? No, they don't. That's, anybody can do that. But they knew. And every morning at 8 o'clock, we would talk. I would go over my concerns. One of them right away was the location of our crash cart. So we're giving vaccines. Patients can potentially have adverse and allergic reactions. And I couldn't find our crash cart. Not that we needed it, but I needed to know where to find it quickly in the event of an allergic reaction. And when I'm going through the list of supplies within the crash cart that I finally found, we had zero epinephrine. So that's a medication that's used to counteract an allergic reaction. I carry one in my purse, several in my purse every day because my son has allergies to eggs and egg products. So I carry one. Benadryl. Our Benadryl was expired. Our bicarb was not there. I mean, they were just missing so many different things in this crash cart. So I made a list and I gave it to the, you know, staff that morning. And they knew. They were aware of all of this. We didn't have a registered nurse on site to give these emergency medications in the event there was a reaction. So they knew. They said that they were working on getting more staff. We had five, think of them as medical assistants. So we have five exam rooms, five medical assistants or research coordinators, and five exam rooms. They're pushing 40, 50, 60 patients a day through these five exam rooms. And that is impossible when you're doing physical exams, when you're taking a medical history, when you're writing down every dose of medication and vitamin that they take, when you're doing a height and a weight, you're doing nasal swabs, you're going over a diary, you're doing informed consent. That should have been first, but you know, it was impossible. And they knew, and they just said, any concerns that you have, eventually, this is their response to me, was to put it on a list. We know we have problems at this point. There are so many that we can't address everything. And I have a recording. I should have had it ready, because it's when she said that to me, we can't address everything right now. I stopped her and I said, I disagree. Right. What if everything that we need to do needs to be done right now? And it does. And I told her that, and she said, well, we just can't.
That's sloppily done.
I'm gonna use your word. Sloppily done. Yes. And so dangerous for the people. And I'm sorry, it just brings back memories of going through that. I mean, it was 18 days of hell and trying to get this company just to do the right thing. And, you know, I never was able to look at the contracts, but I imagine based on my experience in negotiating contracts and budgets that this company Ventavia, I would say anywhere between $10,000 and $12,000 per patient that they enrolled into the clinical trial. And, you know, as a director of operations, I know that revenue is important, you know, to have this coming in as a company. So it wasn't a decision that I made lightly to recommend that they immediately stop enrolling in the clinical trial and report everything to the regulatory authorities and to Pfizer. And they didn't want to do that. And when I made the decision to contact the FDA, I did that.
That was my next question. So you contact the FDA, and I bet you're thinking, okay, they're going to do something. You know, I bet your hope was they would do something. Or
I had no doubt. I had zero doubt that they were going to at least come to the clinical trial site and inspect it. That's their job. When they receive the type of report and concerns that I had, they should have been on site within a matter of days.
But it's that revolving door, which I'm sure you're now, you know, have investigated yourself and discovered yourself, like Julie Gerberding, CDC and Merck and the Gardasil vaccine. And it's a revolving door. And, you know, these people do the dirty deeds from the CDC or FDA. They end up getting a cush job afterwards at this, you know, because Gerberding ended up working for Merck after she did their dirty work. And it's, you can't trust any of these agencies anymore.
Well, and that's where our legislature has to make changes. We have to make laws that prevent this from happening. You know, you cannot trade in stock and be a congresswoman, or, you know, you can't work for the FDA if you're going to take a contract, you know, with a pharmaceutical company later on. Like, it just doesn't, when I figured out that kind of stuff happens, because I just never knew before, I'd never followed it. Okay. You know, I knew that I did my job, and loved it, thought I was always going to be doing that. And then when I was done with my part that I knew was right, correct, and true, and I passed it on to the pharmaceutical company and then passed it on to the FDA, each of them had their job to do. And then at the very end, when we all helped determine whether this was safe and effective, if it was safe and effective, it gets to market. If it wasn't, then it doesn't. To me, it was just that black and white. I guess call me what you will, naive. I'm not anymore. Question everything. I will never forget the first person that told me that, question everything. And now I do. And sometimes it takes a lot out of you to question everything. I miss the person, the girl that I used to be, just carefree and loving her babies and loving, you know, just the things that we did. I still do, right? I still, it's just been very difficult to be my age, I guess, you know, and realize that every aspect of my life besides my little family unit has been really a lie.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation out there. It's, you know, and in fact, I said this on the last episode too, but now the Canadian Mathematics Association is saying, like, you can't just say 2 + 2 = 4 anymore, that's a white, you know, it's a marginalized white Western, you know, answer that marginalizes other answers. Like, come on, this is like Orwellian. 1984, yes. Where if you feel it's true, like, I can be a woman tomorrow, it's true. You know, I feel it's true.
You can't.
Right.
I'm sorry.
You can't. No, it's there's so many of these, you know, issues that the world is just crazy right now. It's probably the most interesting time to be alive, I would say, but it's really unfortunate, you know, what.
Yeah, I'm scared for my kids.
Yeah, that's why I do everything I do. And I unfortunately got involved in politics, and I was never involved either before all this. I didn't trust the government. I didn't trust politicians. And, you know, you mentioned legislation, but I think it's truly, if there's any branch of our government, obviously the executive branch, useless right now, and even our legislative branch, it's really going to come down to the judicial branch, because laws, I hope, still mean something. And maybe through the judicial branch, we force the legislative branch to actually make laws to stop these people from working at CDC and then Merck or whatever it might be. So moving on with yours, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was thinking about, you know, my kids and the things that I'm having to do to make sure that they're kept safe, you know, and, you know, just the whole gender thing and trans LGBTQ, whatever. My kids probably think we're the worst parents on the planet, because we talk about it very openly. You know, but my kids are not allowed to do a lot on their cell phones. You know, I have one teenager just turned 13 and an 11-year-old daughter, and we're monitoring what they're looking at. We're monitoring what they're saying. We have an app on their phone that tells us when they use profanity, when they talk about anything bullying, when there's any sexual content. And, you know, I'm very careful, because I don't want to feel like I'm just in their phone and, you know, being a spy. And we're careful too. You know, they're having conversations with their little friends and text messages, and one of them says a cuss word like hell or, you know, damn. We're not right on top of them saying, why'd you say that? You know, they're having a conversation. But when they use, you know, their friends use other cuss words and stuff, we talk about it. And I think, you know, with technology and just the way families are these days, everything's rush, 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 rush. Everybody's in a hurry. Yeah. You know, we try to slow it down a little bit. And I think doing that and just spending quality times kind of help us keep them wrangled.
Yeah.
Entertained by, you know, this gender stuff. And yeah. I don't know, it's just silly to me. Be what you want, be who you want, but don't shove it down my face. I just have no tolerance for that. I don't care.
Right.
I do care when you want to teach it in my school.
Yeah, that's what I say. Like, when you're a grown adult, we live in America, you know, do what you feel you need to do. Love who you want to love. That's I'm okay. I'm not going to judge you. Not going to judge you. But when you start trying to bring that into my kid's school, my 11-year-old, he doesn't know. We haven't had the birds and bees talk yet. It's my job to know and recognize when he's ready for that conversation and how gradually I want to introduce these concepts. It's not up to the school, but it's statism. This government wants to own our children. And now Minnesota became a genital mutilation destination state. I mean, Minnesota has become just, you know, the center of this movement now. You know, California's bad, East Coast is bad, but they have chosen Minnesota, abortion on demand without any restrictions. I mean, it's gone crazy here, and it's
do you consider ever leaving? I mean, would this be something that would drive you out of your state?
We thought about it after I lost my election. So I ran for state house, and for a day or two, we were thinking Tennessee or Texas, but you know, I don't want to run. We've got family around here and my kids have their friends, and I don't want to run yet. There may come a time though, where that's what you have to do. And
you have to do what's best for you. I was curious. Sorry, I didn't mean to get personal, Mark.
No, that's all right. I think that this, and hopefully the audience appreciates, you know, this type of just open conversation. That's what we're doing here. We're just having a conversation, a couple of freedom fighters that, you know, blew the whistle and really just stuck with it. And more people need to do that. Like, that's when you were talking about your coworkers, the doctors I worked with, and thank God it's been more than 18 days for you, but the time you witnessed that is 18 months for me. This hospital protocol and all the ridiculous, the remdesivir, everything they were doing, the early intubation, I'm just fighting, pulling my hair out. Just no family member there to advocate for them. I mean, it's like, it was all kind of by design, because you can do whatever to this sick, scared patient when there's no family member there. It was all really, it seems, it was all designed perfectly. Like, I was just having a conversation this morning with my friend, like, did they know when they planned this that I now was going to be not wanting to be around vaccinated people, and vaccinated people wouldn't want to be around unvaccinated people? It's like the great divide. How well planned was this, you know?
Yeah, that's, and you know, they laid it out for you, what they were going to do, their plan, and these different, you know, presentations and these different simulations that they're, you know, that they've just made available. So we know what's going on. And I think, you know, like you said, just question everything. That's what I've learned. I like to just be who I am and go really on my gut and what knowledge I do have. I don't like to be so conspiratorial, but it ends up that I'm really not. I'm just kind of right on, because I have looked at history and I've seen how this has gone. So
yeah, the whole woke movement, you know, it's repeating history, because history always repeats. The woke movement is Marxism. There's four pillars: race, safety, religion, and gender. And that's the same with Marxism. You know, safety's the COVID, religion trying to take Christ or religion out of it, and gender, and the whole BLM movement, all this. It's all designed to have a victim class and an oppressor class. We're white, we're oppressors. It's just crazy. My kids are not racist. They have friends of color. But they tell them, you're white, you're racist. So it's just, there's so many.
Well, my kids would tell you that they're not white, they're peach. Yeah. And anybody of color is brown. There's brown and there's peach. That's it. And they don't separate them. It's like when they're describing somebody, you know, maybe it's been a while since they've done that, but I don't know. It's just so innocent, right? Brown, peach. There's no black, white, you know, they just don't see that. And it's a shame that us as adults, those are the ones who teach them that. And they just want to have friends. They just want to go ride their bike. They just want to go crawdad fishing. They don't care who they do it with.
Yeah.
So sad.
It is. And so you end up going to the FDA, get back to your story here, and they ignore you essentially, right? And then you end up getting fired from Ventavia. And there's actually, for the viewers, you can go to iambrookjackson.com. Is that correct?
It is correct, yes.
And the recording of Brooke being told she's terminated is there for you to listen to. But is that how it happened?
Yeah. Literally on the morning of September 25th, after, you know, I tried to get them to do all the right things. I tried to get Pfizer to do the right thing, because at that point, you know, I'd reached out to them, although I did that, you know, anonymously, and just realized that they were they wanted to be first to market. That's what I felt. And excuse me. So I contacted a hotline and spoke to somebody at FDA, and she told me to complete an email and send it to a formal email address. And I did that. And it took 6.5 hours for me to lose my job that same day.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. And I recorded the conversation, right? Because I knew what was coming, because I had tried to send an email. I was working from home this day, this Friday, September 25th. And I tried to send an email and my emails wouldn't go through. So I had a hunch. And just really took it as a, okay, I know that I did the right thing. Now I just have to find another job and pick up and move on. And I watched from the end of September through December of 2020, when the FDA gave Pfizer their emergency use authorization for the 16 and older. And when the New England Journal of Medicine published their paper and a breakdown of the number of patients in the placebo group and the number of patients in the active arm, the patients that actually got the vaccine. And that's a way that they were able to compare the vaccine's safety and, or excuse me, that's efficacy, was to split people and groups that got the vaccine, those that got just an active substance or, saline. And I knew that based on those numbers that Pfizer used my clinical trial sites data in support of their approval. And so when I realized that, I'd, been researching, and from September to December, going through emails, and I really had an opportunity to just realize what information I had. And it wasn't just Pfizer study. We were doing, 20 other clinical trials, and they all looked the same. And the data looked the same. So I was just really spending my time going through that. And when they got their emergency use authorization, I knew that I needed to go a step further. And so I filed the False Claims Act with the Department of Justice on January 8th of 2021. So right after the emergency use came out, we were ready. We'd been working on our complaints. We had been gathering all the evidence and, submitted that January of 21.
Yeah. So, and so,
and that was based on the fact that Pfizer's vaccine was not safe and was not effective and therefore misbranded. I knew that they couldn't make those claims based on using data from a clinical trial site that made it up, that lied, that fabricated the data, that falsified the data, that mixed up lab samples. And because I knew they'd done that and used the data, then their product was misbranded.
Yeah. And I mean, I knew early on, this warp speed, everything. So, there's this video going around of Tony Fauci in Baltimore, I think, talking to people about the vaccine. Oh, how the mRNA technology has been. The guy that was at the door said, this is new technology, that you're testing it on people. You don't know what's that. Oh, Tony says, we've been working on this for decades, or sure, but not on people. We don't know the long-term effects. I mean, I knew right away that no way was I going to come near this thing. And so you're, and I know we can't talk a whole lot, and we're going to have Brooke on again in the future when we can explore more about the court stuff, and we're limited a little bit on to what we can go into there, but
just a few days, we literally, if this was a week later, I'd be able to say a lot more, Mark. I'm so sorry.
No, we'll have you back on. I mean, it's
very cool.
So, but I think I can say the court was thrown out. And that's where we are now. But is it true? Is it your court case that in so many words, that was it Pfizer said we were only providing the fraud that the government wanted, or is that a different case?
No, that's this one. And that quote was made by a good friend of mine. Her name is Sasha Latipova, and her she was giving a speech. She was doing a presentation, and that was, her presentation, that last statement that, we delivered the fraud that the government ordered. That's based on her interpretation of the contract. And you can look at a contract, Mark, I can look at a contract, and we can both interpret it different ways. And, this other transaction authority contract that was negotiated between the Department of Defense and Pfizer is complicated. A lot of attorneys have never even heard of an OTA contract before. And it really, it's taken some time for the attorneys to look through it and understand it. And, that was Sasha's interpretation. And the case, like you said, the False Claims Act case, which was submitted on behalf of the people and the United States government, that was dismissed
weeks, not even, right?
Yeah, a couple weeks. And the judge interpreted the contract in a way that allowed him to decide to dismiss my case. Based on the contract alone. And so we are right now, you know, working with a team of attorneys. I think, you know, at one point there were 17. I'm not sure what number we're at now in terms of how many people are helping with this case. But I know I'm so blessed to have an amazing team that are just exploring different avenues and ways to hold these companies responsible. We want justice and we want accountability. And I think, you know, every one of them that are on this team, including myself, will never stop. I hope that's not what Pfizer and the US government are holding out for, is for me to get tired and give up, because I will tell you, maybe I did early on. I'll tell you, I gave up twice and I was like, screw it, I'm just not going to do this anymore. This is taking too much of me. But I'll tell you what takes too much of me now is what the vaccine injured do to my heart. I just have such a place in my heart for these people that are suffering. And that, along with the fact that, like, now I'm pissed off. I've been pissed off for a long time. I've been hurt. I've been traumatized for so long that now that this judge has decided to dismiss this case that was for the people, like, now I'm really freaking pissed off. And that is enough. Like, they have no idea.
Yeah.
I wish that they knew who they messed with, because I will do whatever it takes. I will lay it all down. I will go broke. I will do whatever it takes to make sure that somebody is held accountable for what Pfizer did in these clinical trials, because it wasn't right. And there's no amount of cover up that can hide what we know, what I have documents for, what other whistleblowers have come forward and said. There's no hiding it.
Yeah. And that statement, what you just said there, that gives me hope. You know, that, thank God, and God bless you.
Like, it
you
makes me so mad. Like, it makes me want to box somebody right now. Maybe, yeah, I'll go for a run when we get off this call. But I'm just, it drives me. It is traumatizing, like I said, and I've had to learn to become okay with that word, because I didn't want to admit that I was traumatized. But what they've done to my family, to me, to science, to research, to these people, is just, I'm not going to tolerate it. So I, you know, maybe that's what they think, that they're going to wear me out. They're going to wear me down, but it will never happen.
Awesome. Yeah. So we're running close to out of time. We're going to have Brooke on again, but I do want to mention, so I just watched a video. Naomi Wolf gave a speech at Hillsdale College, really kind of getting into some more details about side effects and adverse events and how they were hidden, and really the whole scheme of the psychopathy. And you were brought up, Brooke, in this speech. I was listening to it with my wife last night, and I was like, look, it's Brooke. I get to talk to Brooke tomorrow. So, but
you're sweet.
Talking about vaccine injured. So I am brookjackson.com. You can go there and support. And though a lot of the legal work is pro bono, not all of it is. Brooke needs help, but a lot of the funds that are brought in are used to help the vaccine injured, and they need help. They're being ignored. There's no help for these people. And if it, like when Brooke and I were talking before we hit record here, listen to them. They have a story that needs to be heard. Some of them need help financially. And, you know, that's important right now, is we need to show empathy in this world where there is not enough of it. And so please do go to, you can follow Brooke. I am Brooke Jackson on Twitter, her website. Follow the story. I know the story's not over, but we're going to have Brooke on again here, hopefully in a couple weeks, perhaps, and as things develop. I know we will, and I know in this world, I met you at the Anecdotals movie. Another thing, watch Anecdotals, the movie. It's one of those movies you can share with people who probably don't necessarily agree. It's really kind of soft approach to what's happening. I think everyone should be able to see this, and that's where I met Brooke, and I know our paths will intersect, and I'll be able to meet you in person again, and not virtually. I just know it, as we continue to fight this fight. And so I'm going to give you kind of the last word here, but I just want to say thank you on behalf of myself and the viewers of the Truth Expedition. I'm so grateful for everything you've done and continue to do, Brooke.
Well, right back at you, right back at you, Mark. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and to share, you know, the story with your viewers. Congratulations on your show. You know, I think you mentioned something so important, and that is just the vaccine injured need help. And they need an opportunity to be able to share with people what's happened to them personally. And it is hard to hear. It is hard to not want to look away from these people, you know, but they're so deserving. They didn't do anything wrong. They did what they thought was best in the moment. And that's just, it's so hard to know that there are these hundreds of thousands of people out there suffering from a lie, it's so hard. And I just thank you again for the opportunity to come on and to share this story. And like you said, it's not over yet. I will die on this hill, as you said, and never stop fighting. And that is for the people who've been harmed and for those that have lost the people that they love to what our government's done.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And
thank you
again, everybody. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say I'm excited to come back on. And you know, our legal team is, we have just a couple days to file whatever we're going to file in response to the judge motion to be dismissed, you know, him making that decision. And we are gonna have an announcement soon, I'm sure, within the next few days.
Yeah, so awesome. Everybody stay tuned and follow Brooke on Twitter. I am Brooke Jackson, and thank you again, and I know we'll be seeing you very, very soon. Brooke, God bless.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. God bless you too.